Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Hello and welcome to the Renaissance English History Podcast. I'm your host, Heather Tesco. This is episode 63. It's an interview with Linda Porter. She was the historical consultant on the new BBC One series, Six Wives. She also has a new book out on the children of Charles I and the English Civil Wars. Before we get started, though, I need to mention that the Renaissance English History Podcast is a proud member of the Agora Podcast Network. And the Agora Podcast of the Month is the History of Egypt podcast. The History of Egypt podcast is available on iTunes and also at EgyptianHistoryPodcast.com. So check that out. It's a really interesting podcast to listen to. So let me introduce Linda Porter for you. Also, you can get links and show notes and everything like that at my website, EnglandCast.com, E-N-G-L-A-N-D-C-A-S-T, EnglandCast.com. And you can get more information about Linda and all the links to get her books there. Linda Porter has a BA and a Doctor of Philosophy from the University of York. She spent nearly 10 years lecturing in New York at Fordham and City Universities, among others, before returning with her American husband and daughter to England, where she embarked on a complete change of career. For more than 20 years, she worked as a senior public relations practitioner in BT, introducing a groundbreaking international public relations program during the years of BT's international expansion. The attractions of early retirement were too good to miss, and she has gone back to historical writing as well as reviewing for the BBC History magazine, The Literary Review, and History Today. She's now on her fourth book, Royal Renegades, The Children of Charles I and the English Civil Wars. I am so grateful to Linda Porter for taking the time to speak with us. We started off the interview with me asking her about Charles I's view of monarchy and how that influenced his children's views, especially Charles and James.
Okay, well, Charles's view of monarchy is a fairly straightforward one, actually. He felt that he was answerable to no one but God, and that as such he couldn't really be questioned or held to account by his subjects. And this divine right of kings view, which is often associated rather closely with his father, James I, but actually had pervaded the whole of monarchy as an institution for many hundreds of years before that, really. I mean, that I suppose, does find its most literal expression, if you like, in Charles I. Quite how much his children followed that is interesting, I think, because Charles II, having seen what had happened to his father as a result of being entirely unwilling to negotiate or compromise, managed his reign far more successfully, really, than any of the other Stuarts. He was a clever, cynical man who knew how to charm people, but could also be quite ruthless. And he managed to balance the And almost, I suppose, in a way, develop the role of a what we would call a constitutional monarch, but one still with very considerable powers. And in particular, he managed to cope with his parliaments and even dispense with them when necessary in a way that was far more effective than his father had ever done. But I don't think he, while he might privately have supported his father's views on the monarchical institution and its responsibility only to the deity, I think he wasn't willing to pursue this too far in practice, and certainly didn't wish to end up with the same fate as his father. Now, James is a bit different, because James, I think, had absorbed at his father's knee, despite having been deserted by his father on a couple of occasions. I think he had absorbed the belief that kings could do no wrong. And when he came to the throne in 1685 on his brother's death, having been the heir, of course, throughout Charles's reign, he really did have an agenda to try and bring the Catholic faith, which he had converted to probably sometime in the late 1660s. We don't know exactly when. As a boy, he hadn't shown a great deal of interest in it, and he'd been brought up as a Protestant, of course, as were all of Charles's children. But James II, I think, came to the throne at least determined that Catholics would have the same rights, civil, legal, and things like that, as Protestants, which they didn't, of course. The one thing that the Restoration Settlement didn't do was to bring full citizenship back for either Catholic or Protestant nonconformists. And James dressed up his ideas, if you like, in the kind of package that he thought would appeal to both his Catholic subjects and his Puritan stroke nonconformist subjects. But his agenda was really always to restore Catholicism to full acceptability and full legal and civil status. And his subjects were just not willing to have that happen by the time that he lost his throne about 3 years later. It's interesting that he survived the insurrection around his nephew, Charles's illegitimate son, the Duke of Monmouth. People were still willing to work with James II at that point, but he was a man who'd never really accepted that you shouldn't push your luck. And his brother, Charles II, had accepted that during a long and penurious exile. I think that's the difference between the two of them. Of the two, in terms of his belief, James II was much closer to his father, Charles I, than Charles II was. Whatever Charles II might have privately wanted or believed, he knew that to pursue it too far would probably send him abroad on his travels again.
So can you give me, I'm going to skip ahead here a couple of questions just to kind of get an overview of the time period in your book, which is a little bit later than I normally cover in the podcast. So I think for some of the listeners, it might be a little bit unfamiliar. And so this is, of course, the period of the English Civil War and the Protectorate. And can you just kind of give us a little bit of an overview?
Well, Charles, when the Civil War began in 1642, it did so as a result of a long, long background of rising discontent amongst the sort of class of men who represented the English constituencies in Parliament, who were, well, I suppose for want of a better term nowadays, I mean, they were nearly all men of property. They were not men from lower social orders. But because the Stuarts found themselves in a situation largely financial to try and finance various wars in Europe during the early part of Charles I's reign, Charles I's relationship with Parliament became very, very fraught. He wasn't the sort of person who would listen to any demands for a larger role for Parliament. He didn't think that the constitutional situation needed any changing, whereas the parliamentarians, in return for giving him money, wanted something back. Parliaments under the Tudor period had been very much sort of forelock tugging. The Tudors managed parliaments far more successfully than the Stuarts did, but the sort of parameters of the world were slightly narrower and more in the favour of monarchy in the 16th century than they were in the 17th. Really, it was the years that Charles I ruled without Parliament in the 1630s where eventually things broke down, and the troubles that beset him were not just in England, but in the other two kingdoms that he ruled as well, Ireland and Scotland. And in fact, it was Scotland that first rebelled against Charles I in the late 1630s, because he tried to impose the form of worship, the prayer book of the Church of England on Scotland, which was by that time sort of fully Presbyterian. The Kirk didn't like bishops and the whole hierarchy of the Church of England. And when the Scots rebelled, Charles sent an army against them, which was hugely unsuccessful. He needed money if he was going to sort of keep up any pretense of trying to keep the Scots at bay. And in order to get money, he had to recall Parliament after a gap of 11 years. And in 1640, there were two parliaments, the short parliament, which he very unwisely dissolved after just 3 weeks because they wouldn't do what he wanted. And then by the autumn of 1640, he had to call what becomes known as the long parliament, which effectively lasted for 20 years on and off during the whole period of the civil wars. And there was growing discontent with Charles, with his ministers. There was a very serious outbreak of rebellion in Ireland, which fueled anti-Catholicism in England. The Queen herself, Henrietta Maria, was French, Catholic, and extremely unpopular, and had absolutely no political sense whatsoever, and tended to try and encourage her husband down routes which would have been best avoided. So that I don't think anybody wanted civil war in 1642. And it was Charles who raised his standard, first of all, at Nottingham in August 1642. But Parliament was not well prepared to fight, but it was committed to doing so. Now, of course, during the civil war years, really the high point of royalist success was in the second year of the war in 1643, when they were based in Oxford and seemed perhaps to be able to repel the parliamentary forces. And of course, during that period of time, the parliamentarians themselves became much, much more split. They split along religious lines. The idea of greater tolerance for people of different branches of Protestantism gained ground. There was a split between people who were broadly speaking Presbyterians and those who were known as Independents, who I suppose were the forerunners of Protestant sects like baptism and things like that, but who essentially believed that men should be allowed to worship without the folderols of bishops and music and all the kind of things that supporters of the Church of England really enjoyed. And also there were fundamentally different beliefs developing about who should be allowed to vote, you know, what the role of the army was and all that kind of thing. And the more extreme people were actually in the army rather than left behind in Parliament. All of this Charles I tried to manipulate. He thought that because his enemies were split, he would survive and eventually come out of it with precisely what he wanted. Certainly he was right that nobody, absolutely nobody, until perhaps well into 1648, had ever considered that they would need to get rid of him. At least not by killing him. But by the late 1640s, some people had taken the view that he really ought to be encouraged to abdicate, probably in favour of one of his sons. But as the 1640s went on, and the First Civil War ended in 1645 to 1646, and splits amongst the king's opponents grew, Charles was able to manipulate that he hoped he could to some degree. And eventually, having handed himself over to the Scottish army, because the Scots entered the Civil War on the side of the English Parliament, and Charles handed himself over to the Scots army, who were actually encamped at Newark in Nottinghamshire in 1645, which turned out 1646, actually, which turned out to be a big mistake, because he thought he was a guest, but of course he was basically a hostage. And eventually the following year, they sold him literally for money back to the English. He was brought back down to Northamptonshire, where he lived a rather restricted but very genteel life. until, of course, the army decided that he would be better off under their control. He was well treated and brought back to London. He lived in Hampton Court for a while, and he escaped from there on November the 11th, 1647, with apparently absolutely no plan of where he would go and what he would do. And he went to the Isle of Wight, which was a disastrous thing to do, of course, because it was a very difficult place to get away from at all, much to the horror of its newly appointed governor, who desperately did not want this responsibility. And so the king essentially sat out what's known as the Second Civil War, the one which by this time the Scots had changed sides and invaded England on the side of Charles I and were roundly defeated at Preston in the summer of 1648. Thereafter, Charles's existence was, I think, pretty much under threat because people had been willing to do deals with him. Cromwell, Fairfax, who was the head of the army, they had given the king in the summer of 1647 a set of ideas called the Heads of the Proposals, which would have limited somewhat his power as a monarch, but not as much as had originally been thought. And again, at that stage, there was no idea of getting rid of him altogether. But he spurned this offer, and because he did so and had tried to get away from those who were, you know, attempting to do a deal with him, it was thought that he had brought about, you know, the Second War and the bloodshed that went with it. And really, within the army, feelings were gaining a great deal of, distaste for the king. The movement that's known as the Leveller Movement, which was both within the army and outside it, grew. There were calls for, you know, the entire voting system and constitution to be changed to include far more people. Most of the leading army officers didn't like that idea, incidentally. They were not Democrats in the modern sense at all. Eventually, by the time Charles was brought from the Isle of Wight back to the English mainland, and eventually by Christmas 1648 to Windsor, the idea had gained currency that he must be brought to trial because he had essentially committed treason against his subjects. Now, of course, Charles found this idea nonsensical. He went to his death saying a subject and a sovereign were clean different things. But he was eventually put on trial after desperate attempts were made, which are not well known, I think. But really desperate attempts were made over the Christmas period to try and get him to abdicate in favour of his third son, his youngest son, Prince Henry, the Duke of Gloucester. But he wasn't having any of it. And by doing that, he eventually sealed his own fate. My view, and I think that of a number of other historians, is that even when he was brought to trial, he didn't think that they would go through with it, that they would find him guilty and that he would be executed. But of course, he had made a rather major mistake by then. And I think events were sort of spiralling out of control. There was no other outcome after he'd been brought to trial. And by that time, of course, his children were scattered throughout Europe, though two of them remained in England, Elizabeth and Henry, two of the younger children. Charles took a desperately sad farewell of them the night before he was executed, which traumatized Elizabeth. She never really recovered from it. Of course, in his trial and at his execution, he managed to find a kind of greatness which had certainly eluded him as a monarch. It was his finest hour. But in a nutshell, the civil wars took place because the relationship between Parliament and the monarch was breaking down. Then once the fighting broke out, it became apparent that there were all sorts of different threads of ideas and beliefs and opinion amongst his opponents. And those eventually became more and more extreme in the face of a man who was totally intransigent and couldn't understand that he might do better if he actually agreed in good faith to some of the ideas that were put to him.
And this idea, though, must have been so foreign for a king who did think he was answerable only to God. And it must have just been so horrifying to the idea of regicide. And I mean, how do you kind of heal from that as a country?
People did react with horror, yes, throughout Europe. And it's often said that, you know, the crowd that watched his execution groaned, but actually they seem to have watched it in silence. And he was too far away from them for them to hear his final speech, so they didn't know what he actually said. And I mean, the country had not, those who brought him to execution had not intended to form a republic, but there were other republics in Europe. And there was one in Venice, which was ancient and sort of decaying by that time, but there was also one in the Netherlands, what is now the Netherlands. It was known as the United Provinces of the Netherlands then, which was much younger and had fought its way to independence against the Spanish in the late 16th and early 17th century. So there were other models of republic, but no, regicide was considered very much as a kind of last resort for people who couldn't get the king to accommodate himself to their views in any way. But I think once they were committed to it, they did go through with it, of course. Not a lot of the people that Cromwell knew, including some of his closest allies, didn't actually sign Charles I's death warrant. His commander-in-chief, Thomas Fairfax, didn't sign it, and neither did his cavalry commander, John Lambert. And there were others who did balk at the idea of it, I think. But once Charles had gone, the general mood in the country was one of, I think, just waiting and to see what would happen. I mean, his family may have been horrified. We don't precisely know how the information was conveyed to Charles II, who was then living with his sister Mary in the Netherlands, in The Hague. But he was, what, 18, 19 years old. And I think it is probably true that he burst into tears when he's addressed as Your Majesty, which kind of gave the game away somewhat. But there was horror. But within England, not Scotland, which of course was a separate kingdom in those days. It didn't become a part of, the crowns had been of the two countries were united, but the two countries were not. They followed different systems. The Scots came out for Charles II within a month or so of Charles I's death, and it was via Scotland that Charles II initially tried to regain his, unsuccessfully as it turned out, his English kingdom. But, I mean, yes, the children were horrified, I think. I mean, certainly the younger children, Henry and Elizabeth, who had to go through this incredibly harrowing parting from their father the night before he was educated. They had lived in England in a kind of, well, it's not an imprisonment because that isn't quite the right way to describe it. They were effectively, they were left behind, which is quite extraordinary, but they were. When Charles and Henrietta Maria fled from London at the beginning of 1642 after his famous attempt to enter the House of Commons and arrest the members of Parliament he thought were the heads of the rebellion against him, Henrietta Maria and Charles took the future Charles II, James, Duke of York, and Princess Mary, with them downriver to Hampton Court. But Henry and Elizabeth were left behind in St. James's Palace. I don't know what the royal family thought they were doing at that time. I suppose it was just impractical. They must, the other children were closer to hand, and the other two who were younger were simply left behind. And a succession of guardians was appointed for them by Parliament, but they were effectively pawns and in a way hostages. Their father wasn't allowed to see them. He was allowed to communicate with them. He was allowed to write letters throughout all of the Civil War period. He was even allowed to write letters, of course, to his wife and to his son, Charles, when they both went overseas. And he exchanged letters with Elizabeth almost until, you know, the moment of his death. So the younger children were left behind to be brought up and educated as Protestants, with perhaps the view at the back of people's minds that if the situation did get worse, there was in Prince Henry, a young boy, and he was eight when his father died, who could be molded into an acceptable constitutional monarch. And they were still pondering that as a possibility, even in 1653, when after the death of his sister, he was still on the Isle of Wight. Elizabeth and Henry ended up on the Isle of Wight themselves after their father's death. They spent a year living near where I live in Kent, in Penshurst Place, with the Earl and Countess of Leicester. The Countess of Leicester was the sister of the man who'd been their guardian for most of the Civil War, the Earl of Northumberland. These were families who were of the nobility, but had opposed the king, of whom there were quite a few, in fact. And they had had a very pleasant time with the Countess of Leicester, who had a large family of her own and treated them very kindly. But when their brother, Charles II, invaded Scotland, it was thought that they might become the focus for discontent within England. And they were sent across to the Isle of Wight, where Elizabeth soon died. She'd been ill for actually quite a long time. She probably had TB. She eventually caught a chill while out playing bowls, and she got absolutely drenched in a shower of rain, and it turned very quickly to pneumonia, and she died, leaving Henry alone. And he was finally allowed to go to leave England in 1653. He had had a remarkable upbringing, really, quite separate from his parents, of course, whom he didn't know. The story is that when he met his father again in 1647, when Charles was allowed to see his younger children after he'd been put under army control, the king said to him, "Do you know me, child?" And Henry said, "No," because he didn't. You know, he'd been one year old when his parents had fled. And one of the questions you asked, which might be relevant to this, is that the family seemed to have been very close-knit. Well, they were up to a point. I think it's possible to overstress this aspect, actually. Even in the 17th century, royal children were still brought up in pretty much the same way they had been in medieval times. They did not live with their parents. They did live together, all of them. They spent winters in London in St. James's Palace and summers either at Richmond or Hampton Court to get away from the city when it was unhealthy and you were likely to get the plague. When Charles II was about 8 years old, the future Charles II, he was given a household of his own, which had always happened to the heir to the throne. And he didn't live with his siblings any longer, though he did see them fairly often. Charles and Henrietta Maria were certainly much more interested and affectionate parents. Well, Charles was anyhow. It's hard to describe Henrietta Maria as an affectionate mother, really. But they certainly were closer to their children. They came to visit them often. They took an interest in their education. The children came to court to be sort of schooled in how one behaved under such circumstances as royal children. But they didn't live together as a family. They never did. That is one of the reasons why Elizabeth and Henry were left behind in London in 1642. And so the children would have always been educated separately. Charles does seem to have been a very fond father, and his children were very, very fond of him as well. Their mother was a rather more shrill and forbidding figure, I think, which is strange because she had grown up in a very sort of loving and social household with her brood of brothers and sisters, some of whom were illegitimate and some of whom weren't. She was the youngest of the legitimate children of Henry IV of France and Marie de Medici. And she had had a very happy childhood. But she doesn't seem to have felt quite the same way about her own children, unfortunately. I mean, she did take a great interest in them, but it was of a rather sort of proprietorial sort.
Well, she was really young, though, too, wasn't she, when she first... Well, I guess not that much younger than...
She was young when she married... She was young when she married Charles I. Yes, she was 15. And she didn't have... Well, she had a child in 1629. The marriage was extremely stormy and difficult to begin with. I mean, Charles was a remote young man, nearly 10 years older than her, who was trying to come to grips with being king himself. He'd only been on the throne for 3 months when they married. And he had many things to occupy him. And he was greatly influenced by the Duke of Buckingham, who was his favourite. Some people think that Buckingham deliberately tried to sort of exclude Henrietta Maria from the marriage and make things difficult for her. He certainly succeeded in doing that, even if he hadn't set out deliberately to do it. And really, she and her husband fought almost constantly until Buckingham was assassinated, which was probably a profound relief for Henrietta Maria, sure. I should think. And it was only after that that she became pregnant for the first time. And her first child, born in 1629, was a boy, and he died within a few hours of being born. I mean, we tend to think that in those days people accepted this sort of thing because it happened so often, but it must have been quite shattering, I think. But yes, at that age, she was about 19. And that wasn't terribly young for a queen to be giving birth in those days. But she never really seems to have, use a modern word, bonded with her children successfully. And their relationships with her as adults were always quite difficult. As small children, they seem to have been extremely fond of their father. I mean, the one exception to that is the youngest child, Princess Henrietta, who eventually ends up being known as Henriette Anne when she went to France, who was born in Exeter in the middle of the Civil War in 1644. When Henrietta Maria left London with her husband in January 1642, she immediately took Princess Mary to the Netherlands, because Mary had been married at the tender age of 9 to William of Orange, the heir of the leading Dutch noble house. It was a marriage that Henrietta Maria didn't want, and Mary, who was a child who very strongly resembled her father, both physically and in terms of her personality, she viewed it as beneath her for the entirety of her life. But her mother went across with her to try and get arms and support for her husband in the struggle that everyone knew was going to ensue, made herself very unpopular in the Netherlands, and eventually came back in 1643. And Princess Henrietta was conceived while the royal couple were in Oxford, and was actually born in Exeter, because it was obvious that Henrietta Maria needed to get away from encircling parliamentarian armies who would have arrested her if they could have found her, because they held her largely responsible for much of the king's attitude. That probably isn't true. She was she wasn't backwards in coming forwards when it came to giving advice and instructions, but Charles by no means did what she said. And in fact, he occasionally said for God's sake, will you shut up and sit down? Though he did love her very much, I think, but he wasn't a yes man for his wife. So it was easy to depict him that way in propaganda. The children were part of they were close to each other. They were a happy family unit. James rejoined his younger brother and sister in 1646 after his father abandoned him in Oxford. And he lived with them for several years. So they knew each other well and spent a lot of time in each other's company. Henrietta was eventually spirited to France by her redoubtable governess and grew up very much under the thumb of her mother. And although she'd been baptized and christened as a Catholic in Exeter, as a Protestant in Exeter Cathedral, she was actually, of course, brought up by her mother as a Catholic, even though it was expressly against her father's wishes. And sort of very pathetically and sadly, Charles did meet his daughter. His little daughter. He saw her just once. He entered Exeter after his wife had fled, and the baby Henrietta was not well when she was first born. I don't think her life was actually in danger, but she was certainly rather a sickly baby, and he was sort of much moved by her powerlessness, I think, and what he and others had brought the family to. So it is a very sad story from a family perspective, and it mirrors that of many other families in the Civil War, of families who were divided by geography, by religion, because, of course, Charles's children, though theoretically brought up as Protestants, and Mary, Henry, and Elizabeth definitely were committed Protestants. Henrietta Maria tried unsuccessfully on several occasions to get her eldest daughter Mary to convert and was completely repulsed. She was told to go away, but Mary didn't get on with her mother very well. She didn't get on with anybody, actually. Poor Princess Mary. She had a very sad life, too. Well, having said that, she lived in the Netherlands quite close to her aunt, the exiled Queen of Bohemia, another Princess Elizabeth Stuart. And so she did have family near her and an aunt who was very affectionate and keen to try and support her. So she wasn't as isolated as perhaps she might have tried to make out. And of course, Elizabeth and Henry were brought up very closely together and educated together. Henry had acquired habits of sort of resilience and independence of thought, which his mother found most distasteful when they finally met again when he went to France in 1653. And she set about trying to convert him to Catholicism, and he got torn between his mother and his brother, who was trying to regain the throne, and said to him, "If you convert, you know, my chances are absolutely nil. You must not do this." And eventually, of course, Henrietta Maria dismissed him and disowned him and said she would never see him again. And indeed, she never did, of course, because when he and James returned with Charles II in 1660, Henry, who was not quite 21 at the time, took his seat in the House of Lords, and Charles had the luxury of having two brothers as heirs, which was most and two brothers that he got on with as well, which was most unusual. But of course, Henry caught smallpox in September 1660 and died at the end of a. He was a prince of great promise, I think, and his life was very sad, as was that of his sister, whom he had, you know, grown up with and must have missed desperately when she died on the Isle of Wight. He was left with a very caring and considerate tutor, an elderly gentleman called Richard Lovell, who was known to the Leicester family in Kent. That was how he got appointed. And his mother tried even to separate him from his tutor when he got to Paris. She dismissed Richard Lovell. So all in all, it was a difficult time to be a Stuart child, really, I think. But they were a close family, and Charles II, close to his younger brother James throughout the whole of his reign. He didn't always agree with him, but he would not countenance the idea that any illegitimate child of his should somehow leapfrog into the succession and remove his brother from it. So they were all close to one another. And without Princess Mary in the Netherlands, who'd become a widow by the year 1650, her young husband predeceased her. The marriage hadn't been happy anyhow. And by that time, she had a son, of course, who would become the future William III of England. But she, although not supposed to, gave her brothers in exile a great deal of financial and personal support. And without that, I think their situation would have been even more difficult than it already was. And her loyalty to the family was absolutely unstinting.
It's so interesting, just this saga.
It is an interesting saga, yes, and a very sad one. I'm afraid it isn't one that has a happy ending, really. Because, of course, what happened to Princess Henriette Anne, whose name was, you know, changed to the French version, and then the name of her aunt, the French regent Anne of Austria, was added onto it. Her life was probably the strangest of all, really, I think, because she had been patronised and looked down upon by Louis XIV and members of the French court for all of the time that she and her mother were eking out a rather meagre existence in the Palais Royal, you know, with very little furniture and not even enough firewood for heating in the winters. And she had been brought up under her mother's thumb. She was desperately sad about what happened between her mother and her brother, Prince Henry. And she was just a little girl of 10 at the time. And, of course, her life changed when her brother was restored to the throne. And suddenly she became one of the most marriageable young ladies in Europe. And she married Louis XIV's younger brother, Philippe, the Duke of Orléans, who himself had had a very difficult childhood, being brought up as second fiddle to his brother and constantly reminded of the fact that he didn't have a role, was inferior and was generally useless. And he had rebelled in all sorts of ways. He was bisexual and had a series of male lovers, which Princess Henrietta knew all about, of course. I mean, she probably didn't know necessarily before she married him, though in those sort of courts, rumours were rife, but one doesn't know how protected people were from them. And the marriage was spectacularly ghastly and unhappy. Although they both shared quite a number of interests, oddly enough. They were both great patrons of the arts. They loved the theatre. They loved dancing. They weren't greatly into hunting and sporting activities or anything like that. But what they were much more divided by personalities, and their interests didn't unhappily really bring them together. And his marriage to Henrietta had actually liberated Philippe of Orléans quite considerably from his brother's control, because he suddenly got a household and finances and income and all that sort of thing of his own. He was a great builder. He set about restoring Saint-Cloud and the Palais Royal and all that. Again, things that his wife approved of. But his wife had become a hopeless flirt. I don't know whether this was a reaction to the strict upbringing she'd had from her mother. But she did flirt with almost everyone, including Louis XIV. And not surprisingly, Philippe didn't like it. And his way of keeping her under control was to keep her almost constantly pregnant throughout their marriage. Various children came and went and died. Eventually, two girls survived. The line of the younger girl have a legitimate claim to the English throne, of course, in the Comte de Paris. Eventually she came back to England as far as Dover to negotiate a secret treaty with her brother on behalf of her brother-in-law, Louis the 14th, in which Charles II effectively sold his country for money to Louis the 14th. Being Charles II, he took the money but didn't do anything else that he was supposed to do. He was clever, was Charles II. But when Henrietta got back to France, she'd obviously been unwell for quite a long time. She was incredibly thin and a very sort of hyper young woman. She suffered from insomnia and was generally sort of unwell. And she collapsed one evening. She thought she might have been poisoned, but an autopsy showed that she'd died of peritonitis, probably caused by a burst stomach ulcer. So she too was dead by the age of 26.
Wow. You've been so generous with your time. Can you just tell us really briefly a little bit about the Six Wives show and what your work was on that?
Yes, of course I can. Yes, the first episode of which aired last night. I think I've probably seen it about half a dozen times, actually. But my husband hasn't seen it, so we'll watch
it. I just watched
tonight.
It on iPlayer this morning, actually.
Well, there's been an interesting reaction to it over here. I suppose perhaps a fairly predictable one. Many viewers on Facebook and all that sort of thing seem to have really loved it, but the critics are fairly sniffy about it. It was a very interesting project to work on because I was involved not right from the beginning, but fairly early on. It was about this time last year, may have been even late November, that I was first contacted to work on it with the team at Wall to Wall who were producing it. And I said yes, I would do it without quite realizing how much would be involved in it. And my role was it was rather more than just checking for horrible errors and factual inaccuracies, because they needed advice on all sorts of things, from costumes to what sort of prayers would be used to bless marriage beds, and it even took me into areas that I hadn't been in before. there were quite considerable gaps when I wasn't involved, and then when I was brought back in and had to respond to things in very quick time, because as you know, if you're working with the media, you can't say, oh, well, I'll just go to the archives for the next week and look that up, because, you know, that isn't the kind of time scale they can relate to at all. So you do need to be able to respond quite quickly, which I suppose means that you need a fairly broadly based knowledge of the period. It's an interesting approach to have Lucy sort of embedded as a servant in the court to watch what's going on. And it's divided into the three episodes. The first is on Catherine of Aragon, the second on Anne Boleyn and Jane Seymour, and the third looks at the last three wives, Anne of Cleves, Catherine Howard and Catherine Parr. And I think as a historical consultant, you have to step back from it a little bit. There were some scenes that were included which I know did not take place historically and would not have done so, in fact. But after some discussion, I let them pass because, you know, the idea is to try and tell a story after all. And so that was why, I mean, if you're a purist, a real purist in the period, I'm sure you will find things to object to. I mean, one example is that there is a scene in which, it's in the first one, you must have seen it yesterday, in which Princess Mary is sort of running around before the Chateau Vert. Well, I pointed out that, you know, any servant who let a royal child do that would probably have been for the chop, quite literally. And that even nowadays, I don't suppose in public functions like that, that Prince George and Princess Charlotte are allowed to run around by themselves. But I was overruled on this. That's why it went in. But again, I don't think it's important in the overall aspect of the programme. And I think it looks very beautiful. And the idea is, of course, that it will engage an audience who aren't accustomed to watching history programmes.
Many thanks to Linda Porter for taking the time to speak with us. Remember that you can get links to buy all of her books, including the new one, Royal Renegades, The Children of Charles I and the English Civil Wars, at my website, englandcast.com. Also, I'm happy to announce or say that her publisher has given us three copies of the new book to give away. So you can enter the contest to get a free copy of the book at englandcast.com as well. So thank you to Linda and her publisher for that. I will be back again very soon to talk about the Tudor Times Person of the Month, which is Bess of Hardwick. We talked about Bess of Hardwick about a year ago or so. So instead of rehashing her life, we actually focused the conversation around widows' rights and the role of women in finance and careers, things like that in the 16th century, because Bess of Hardwick is an amazing example of what intelligent women could do and how they could rise. So stay tuned for that very soon. Thank you so much for listening, and thanks to Linda Porter again. Bye-bye.
Blow, northern wind, a scent will make me sweating. Blow, northern wind, blow, blow, blow. Ich hotte bord in Bauerbrick, at solis semlis on sea.